So we've looked at the origin of the universe, and there's really good reasons to believe that that would begin by a transcendent creator of some kind. The fine-tuning of physical law would imply some kind of a mind that could finely tune life, a life-prohibiting universe. And then the origin of life itself, when we look into this in the biological realm on the microscopic level, that I feel like is a powerful argument. What really trips Christians up, and skeptics too, is how do we integrate our theology about the Bible with the theory of neo-Darwinism, the neo-Darwinian synthesis? How does evolution interact with creation? Richard Dawkins, again, in The Blind Watchmaker, he said, quote, "Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist." He said, before this, you had David Hume, who tried to discount miracles and so forth. But he said, but to look out at the grandeur of the world, the entire animal kingdom, and to see what he calls the apparent design, not that there's real design, but apparent design, he said, something needs to explain this. And he says, Darwinism explained it. So you could be an atheist and you'd have an explanation for the apparent design in nature. Dawkins also said in the New York Times, quote, "If you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that." Then he goes on to talk about how Christians are so intolerant in the same article. Not only are they ignorant, stupid, or crazy, but they're also wicked as well. Well, this is kind of an extremist view, isn't it? Most people wouldn't fall this far on the pendulum swing. And yet, to be sure, Darwinism has become kind of a self-identification in Western culture. I've never walked up to somebody and they've said, yeah, I'm a Keplerian. Excuse me? Yeah, I believe in Johann Kepler. What? I'm a Newtonian. What? You're a what? Yeah, I believe in Isaac Newton's work. Well, of course, we all do, yeah. But I have heard people say, I'm a Darwinist. I'm a Darwinist. And really, this whole field of Darwinian evolution, when it came out, it's actually antecedent to Darwin by Wallace, but it was pretty much at the same time. This whole idea, once it caught, the idea that you go from simple to complex, this was pervasive in multiple different fields. Religion, that you go from simple gods to one infinite personal god. Economics, that the strong eat the weak, that the rich dominate the poor. Morality, everything. Everything had a Darwinian explanation. Why do we value beauty? Well, it was because of this Darwinian pathway. Why do we value altruism? Well, there's this Darwinian pathway. And basically everything was supposedly explained by Darwinism. The difficulty with the subject and why many Christians just throw up their hands on this subject is that it is so interdisciplinary. It's so difficult because you're dealing with paleontology, genetics, anthropology, zoology, environmental science, etc., etc., etc. So most Christians, you have one stripe of Christian who says, well, the universe was created 10,000 years ago. There is no evolution. End of story. The Bible says it. I believe it. That settles it. Because they don't want to get into all this, because that's a lot of science to get into. It's not like physics for fine-tuning. It's not like cosmology for the origin of the universe. I mean, we're talking about multiple different disciplines that we'd have to study. On the other extreme, you have people that are in the sciences, and they feel like, I don't want to have to, you know, empty my brains in order to believe in the Bible. And so this would be the theistic evolution camp, where they just say that the Bible basically lines up completely with Neo-Darwinism, from start to finish. Many Christians fall in the middle, where they just say, yeah, the Bible could be consistent with evolution. And you kind of press on that, and you're like, how? And they don't really know, but they don't really want to know. Because in order to know, you got to do a lot of study. Biblical study, philosophical study, and also scientific study. What we want to do is try and develop a worldview that can account for and seek to understand how to integrate Darwinian evolution with the biblical account. And how do these two things go together? especially with people who are scientifically minded. So maybe you aren't into the sciences, but what if you lead a scientist to Christ and they start to ask some of these deep questions? How are you going to answer? There's a Chinese paleontologist by the name of J.Y. Chen. He says, in China, we can criticize Darwin, but not the government. In America, you can criticize the government, but not Darwin. So true. To even say, well, how did that happen? Or how do you explain this? All of a sudden, people start to feel like, oh, you're anti-intellectual. You're stupid. Some of the rhetoric is so bad. Prothero, Jerry Coyne, they compare anyone who denies the full neo-Darwinian synthesis to a Holocaust denier or to even a flat earther. That is how high the rhetoric has become here. We want to explore this here tonight. To be sure, there's a spectrum of evolution. On the one extreme, you could have somebody like a Richard Dawkins. Or, in the Christian camp, you would have the BioLogos Foundation. It was started by Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project, a brilliant scientist, who believes that everything from molecules to man was an undirected process that God basically set up at the beginning and set up the physical laws to basically take over. And that created humans. In God's foreknowledge, he knew that humans would come from these processes. On the other extreme, you have somebody like a Ken Ham. Ken Ham is the president of Answers in Genesis. And he would be more of the, I don't know if you could think of a more conservative young earth creationist than Ken Ham. Believes the earth is 10,000 years old. Humanity is 4,000 years old. And that's the end of it. That settles it for Ken Ham. Or excuse me, 6,000 years old, not 4004 BC, 6,000 years old. Myself, I'm somewhere in the middle. I hold kind of a moderate view on this. My view, as we're going to get into next week further, the different views on Genesis, I'll give you my view, is I'm a progressive creationist. So I'm not a theistic evolutionist, where it's just molecules to man, undirected process. I'm also not a young earth creationist, where the earth is 10,000 years old, humanity is 6,000 years old. I believe that the universe is 13 billion years old, the earth is 4.5 billion years old, humanity is tens of thousands of years old. And God used evolution to some degree, but I also believe that he intervened, because he is a creative God, and I believe that... Well, I don't know where, I don't know when. If somebody really put a gun to my head and said, well, where did he intervene? I don't really feel comfortable saying that. Like, I know he intervened to create this or create that. But I feel very uncomfortable saying he didn't intervene at all. So I hold to kind of an agnostic position that it wasn't a completely undirected process. At the same time, it wasn't like Fantasia, where God just popped all the animals from nothing. But that there was spontaneous bursts of creation, and then there was evolution, and then there was spontaneous bursts of creation and evolution and spontaneous bursts of creation. We'll get more into that next week. Tonight, we just want to deal with the science. And we want to begin with the fossil record because it's the most hands-on, I guess you could say. Here is a kind of a simple version of the fossil record going from invertebrates. Those are mammals or animals without a spinal cord, jawless fish, to jawed fish, to amphibians, to reptiles, to dinosaurs, to early mammals, to monkeys and apes, to modern mammals and humans. That would be kind of the 30,000-foot, 500-mile-an-hour view of the fossil record. What's interesting about this is somebody who believes in universal common descent has kind of a point. You know, they say we don't find monkeys and apes back in the Mesozoic era or the Paleozoic era. That would immediately falsify evolution. If in this strata here, if you could find, you know, an early mammal in the strata with a jawed fish, that would immediately falsify evolution. Instead, what we find in the fossil record is generally moving from less complex to more complex. And so this would be an argument in favor of universal common descent. At the same time, when we open up our Bibles to Genesis 1, what do we see? We see a pattern of God creating, which moves from generally less complex animals and organisms to generally more complex, ending in humans. In fact, Homo sapiens are the final species to be created, and the Genesis account gets that right. While at the same time, the Genesis account says that God said, and it was, it also says, let the earth bring forth. Let the earth bring forth such and such. So it could be a mixture of the two. Let's think about the fossil record for a moment. Charles Darwin himself, 1859, in his book On the Origin of Species, says, why then is not every geological formation and every stratum, you know, the strata, the different stratigraphy refers to the different layers of rock, why is not every stratum full of such intermediate links? Like to go from a bat to a whale, think about how many different changes you'd need. Or to go from a terrestrial whale to an aquatic whale, basically a wolf to a whale, how many changes would you expect to see, transitions? He says, why isn't the fossil record just filled with transitions? Darwin says geology assuredly doesn't reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. It's interesting, most people don't know that when Darwin's book was published, his biggest critics weren't church people, weren't Christian, they were fossil experts, paleontologists. That we don't see this reflected in the fossil record. Well, that was back in 1859. Give the guy a break. That's 150 years ago plus. We are still seeing the same problems today. Stephen Jay Gould, he was an American paleontologist. You know, paleo means old, and ontos means form or essence, these different forms of life. So paleontologist studies old bones, old organisms. And Stephen Jay Gould is an evolutionary biologist out of Harvard, 1977. He says the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. Full stop. The rarity of transitional forms, this is a trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. That's interesting to consider. Now, he's writing as a Harvard paleontologist. This is the guy who has seen the fossils, who has seen the data. And he's saying, we have transitional forms on the tips and nodes, but not in between the main branches. He writes, we fancy ourselves as the only true students of life's history, yet to preserve our favorite account of evolution by natural selection, we view our data as so bad that we never see the very process we profess to study. How did Gould answer this? Think about that. Why would he say that? Now, he's a full Darwinian evolutionist. How could he say we don't see the transitional forms? A Harvard paleontologist. Think about that for a second. Niles Eldridge, American biologist, paleontologist, curator in the Department of Invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History. This guy is a heavy hitter. He says, when we do see the introduction of evolutionary novelty, something new that evolution produces, it usually shows up with a bang and often with no firm evidence that the fossils did not evolve elsewhere. Evolution cannot forever be going on somewhere else. Yet that's how the fossil record has struck many a forlorn paleontologist looking to learn something about evolution. Now that's interesting to consider. A lot of times people put forward an intermediate, a transitional form. They say, for example, Archaeopteryx is an intermediate between birds and reptiles. But here's the key. This is Eldridge's point. He says evolution can't keep going on somewhere else. There is such a thing as a true intermediate, like going from, let's say, your grandfather to your father to you, and they find your father's bones. That's a true intermediate. But to find someone that looks like your father across the other side of the globe and their bones are dated 10,000 years ago would not explain you, would it? And so many of the morphological, which means the form of an organism, many of the forms that they say, hey, here, this looks similar, that would fill in the gap between these two organisms, These are morphologically intermediate. Like they look like this could fit into the gap, but they're not true intermediates. They're not in the same geography, and they're not in the same time. And so many problems arise here when people say, well, we've got many intermediates. Yeah, but are they actually intermediates that you're saying lived at the time and are the ancestors that fill in the gap? So how does Eldridge explain this and how does Gould explain it? They came up with an idea called punctuated equilibrium. Punctuated equilibrium. And when they came out with this, the hardcore, old school, old guard neo-Darwinists wanted to hang them from a spike. Because punctuated equilibrium states that there are gaps in the fossil record. That's why they had to come up with the theory. They said, we gotta face it. There's gaps in the fossil record. And punctuated equilibrium states that basically what you have is big amounts of species, but then maybe a little part of the species kind of gets culled off, not killed, but separated from the pack. They go through a bunch of evolution. They have a bunch of generations, a bunch of mutations, and then they produce novelty, like a new species. But because it's such a small group, they don't leave behind that many fossils. Consequently, the environment changes, or new predators come in, and they wipe out all the old species. And then the new species proliferates and has kids, and then they take over. And so it's punctuated equilibrium. So equilibrium staying the same, and then you have times of punctuation in the fossil record. Punctuation. Well, the gradualists, like classic Darwinists, they hated this concept. Because basically what it's admitting is that there are jumps in the fossil record. I respect Gould and Eldridge for this reason. They're trying to at least explain from a naturalistic perspective why we do have these big gaps. Why would that not work? Well, there's so many different problems with punctuated equilibrium. One problem is you don't have a big enough population size, enough population genetics, enough generations, and enough mutations for this ever to occur, to produce that much novelty. And this is all happening somewhere else in secret, and they're not leaving behind any fossils. It really doesn't avoid the problem. I'll tell you what it does do. It admits the problem. It admits that there's an issue. Let me give you one example. Now, we could list numerous examples of punctuated times in the fossil record. For example, insects. When insects come on the scene, birds, avian life, they come on the scene in 10 million years, from 65 million years to about 55 million years. 95% of the species of birds appear from 65 million years ago to 55 million years ago. 95%. And have you ever looked at the engineering of a bird? Hollow bones, lift, flight, moving in pattern. Have you ever seen those documentaries of, 2,000, 3,000 birds all moving together in a swarm and not one of them bumps into another? So we're seeing big bangs in the fossil record all over the place. I just want to focus on this one here because it's my favorite. This is called the Cambrian Explosion. Remember the movie Jurassic Park? Why do they call it that? Because it's from the Jurassic period. Why do they call it the Cambrian Explosion? Because it's from the Jurassic period. That's right. No, yeah, Cambrian period. All right, the Cambrian Explosion. This is in 1995. Time magazine had a cover story called Evolution's Big Bang. New discoveries show that life as we know it began in an amazing biological frenzy that changed the planet almost overnight. That's a little bit of media craze there. Almost overnight, 5 to 10 million years. That's what they meant to write there. But evolution's Big Bang, they're right on that. This is moving super fast. Check this out. Life begins on Earth roughly 3.8 billion years ago. Before 3.8 billion years ago, you had from 4.2 to 3.8 billion years ago what was called the Hadean Era. They call it the Hadean Era because the Earth was being bombarded with asteroids and the surface of the Earth was hellish, like Hades. It was covered in fire. No life could arise. As soon as the Hadean Era was over, we have our first fossils of primitive life, 3.8 billion years ago. And it stays that way. Single-celled life from 3.8 billion years ago to 3 billion years ago, to 2.5 billion, to 2 billion, to 1.5 billion to 1 billion until you hit about somewhere around 540 million to 490 million years ago. And then all of a sudden you go from single-celled life to what's called the Ediacaran period, which is right before the Cambrian, where you have these kind of like sponges and this kind of fauna. They're not sure if it was fish or what it was, but they're like sponges, single-celled and then maybe a sponge, until you have all of this. And these are the vast majority of phyla in the biological realm. So you go from single-celled organisms to almost every type of phyla in the biological realm today. So it's something like 14 out of the 16 phyla. And you have a complex animal life here. I mean, just look at these things. I mean, it looks like something out of an alien movie, sci-fi movie. And to have all of these, you know, complex eyes, nervous systems, you have shells, you have bonied, armored species that live underwater. And, you know, things that resemble jellyfish, basically all the basic body types that we're going to have from here on out. And boom, all of a sudden, there they are in the Cambrian era. So that's why they call it the Cambrian explosion. And this occurred in a short amount of time. As I said, they originally placed this at about 540 million to 490 million years ago. And so they said, well, it happened over 50 million years. And so again, you're using a God of the gaps argument. But once again, let me say, this is a gap that hasn't closed. This is a gap that's become more and more inexplicable. It's actually opened. Instead of 540 to 490 million years ago, we've actually discovered that the main explosion happened in 530 to 520 million years ago. Many paleontologists actually place it somewhere around 5 million years of a gap. So this gap has actually shrunk from 50 million to 10 and now down to 5. And the citations I'm giving you here are from the world's leading experts in this period and on this subject. Charles Marshall is top of his field. James Valentine, Douglas Irwin, this is from their graduate textbook on the subject called The Cambrian Explosion, The Construction of Animal Biodiversity. Irwin and Valentine, they refer to this as almost a geological instant. So to you, you're like, all right, yeah, but it's still 5-10 million years. That's a really long time. Geologically speaking, that is instantaneous. Think about it like this. You think about life on Earth as like a full day. So you start at midnight, clock hits 1 o'clock a.m., 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock, noon, nothing, no changes. 1 p.m., 2 p.m., 3 p.m., no changes. 4 p.m., 5 p.m., 6 p.m., no changes. 7 p.m., 8 p.m., 8:30, 8:45, 8:50, 8:59, no changes, single-celled life. And then at 9 p.m., in the period of 2 minutes, you have the majority of the animal phyla that we still have today. So nothing happens until everything happens. Again, that's why they call it the Cambrian explosion. And thirdly, this is a global, not a local event. This isn't something that evolution, you know, happened in a certain location or a locale where it would seem to make sense that, you know, it would blow up in one area. When we look at paleontology, we find these fossils, originally the biggest trove of fossils, and even to this day, was up in the Burgess Shale in Canada. They found something like 70,000 specimens, and they came across these, and they were just like, what on earth are these? And when do they date? They date about a half a billion years ago. But they've also found these in Greenland, and they've also found these in Zhenjiang, China. And so we found these all over the globe, almost like this was a global event. Irwin and Valentine, they write this. They say during a, relatively narrow time span in the early Cambrian, after about 542 million years ago, there's an explosive appearance of many different morphologically distinct fossils, including representatives of most of the major animal groups that are alive today. The scrappy fossil record improved with a bang, geologically speaking. During this time, nearly all the major living animal groups or phyla that have skeletons first appeared as fossils. This has been compared by John Gribben, who is a science writer, citing Stephen Jay Gould, that the tree of life, according to Darwin, was like your typical tree, where you have LUCA, last universal common ancestor. That's at the root, like a single-celled life. And then you have, you know, branches that go up from the trunk and then go out and then they get out into branches. And that's the traditional Darwinian view here. Gribben, citing Gould, says actually what we see in the fossil record is more like a Christmas tree, where instead of starting small and then spreading out, we actually start with all of the different phyla. And then we see that it forms into different families and orders and classes and species. So, how do neo-Darwinists respond to this? They argue that the fossil record is incomplete. And to this, we would have to say, agreed. That's true. Most animals were digested, eaten, the properties, the sedimentation just wasn't propitious for leaving fossils behind. And yeah, so most fossils didn't survive. And so they're right about this. However, that being the case, is this a good argument against the Cambrian explosion being a creative act of intelligence? No. I'll give you a few reasons why. Number one, many soft-bodied organisms were preserved in the Cambrian explosion. So that should get you to think a little bit. We're going back half a billion years. And they're saying, well, you know, you go from single-celled life and like maybe like a sponge to like a totally, you know, decked-out, bony invertebrate. But there are probably these intermediates or precursors that get you from a sponge to something like a aquatic tank, right? There's probably these precursors. They just didn't survive in the fossil record. Well, why? Well, because they're soft-bodied. Of course, the Cambrian fossils would survive. They're made out of bone. They're skeletons. Of course they would survive. But the soft-bodied precursors, intermediates, they wouldn't have survived because they're like jellyfish. No wonder we don't see them. The problem is many soft-bodied organisms were preserved in the Cambrian strata. The Burgess Shale, this collection, had 70,000 specimens. 95% were soft-bodied. That comes from Simon Conway Morris. So, so much for the idea that, oh, they just, the sediment and stuff, it just didn't fossilize these soft-bodied creatures. The Cambrian strata fossilized 95% were soft-bodied. How about that? We also have to ask the question, how could like bony, armored precursors to the Cambrian not be preserved? So to go from like, you know, a sponge to like a trilobite, like a bony armored tank, aquatic organism in the water. There's got to be like a bunch of intermediates, right? I mean, everyone agrees with that. Sponge to an aquatic tank, yes? And so there's got to be like a skeletal version of that that's a precursor. But no, none of those survived. We don't have any precursors to the trilobite. Those didn't survive. But we have many soft-bodied creatures which did survive. So all of the armored ones, we don't have those, but we do have all the soft-bodied ones. Again, Eldridge, he says, the record jumps, and all the evidence shows that the record is real. The gaps we see reflect real events in life's history, not the artifact of a poor fossil record. He's right about that. Yes, many were missing, but this is an argument from a conspicuous silence. We should expect to see the precursors or the intermediates, but we don't. Number two, just to give you an idea on this, microfossils dating to over 3 billion years ago. So these are soft-bodied, microscopic, 3 billion-year-old fossils. We have those. We don't have the millions and millions and millions of intermediates from a single-celled organism to a trilobite. Those weren't preserved from, you know, half a billion years ago. But the micro, soft-bodied single-celled organisms from 3 billion years ago, we do have those. Number three, fossil conditions were better in the pre-Cambrian era, the Ediacaran era. And this comes from Irwin and Valentine. What's their point? Their point is, if you wanted better fossil conditions, it wouldn't be in the Cambrian era. It would be in the time just before the Cambrian era. At that time, fossils were more easily preserved, and yet this is the same time that we don't have fossils to fill in the gap.